Psychology at Work. A podcast series exploring the work of professionals in the mental health care field, developed by the Psychology Department at Western Connecticut State University. Hello, this is your host, Shane Murphy, and today I'm interviewing Dr. Eric Fraser, a noted forensic psychologist here in Connecticut and on the adjunct faculty at Yale University.
Well, thank you very much for coming in today and for volunteering your time, and we're looking forward to your talk immediately after this.
Yeah.
But the interviews are basically about sort of what you do and how you got there. So let me start off with maybe just a brief description of what it is that you do on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. So the great thing about what I do as a forensic psychologist, and I want to just take one step back and say, a forensic psychologist is a clinical psychologist with specialized training in forensics. So you don't get a degree in forensic psychology as a psychologist. You can get a degree in forensic psychology, but that doesn't necessarily mean you become a forensic psychologist. There are different gradations to that, which I won't get into. The greatest thing about being a forensic psychologist is that every single day there's something different walking through my door. There's some different kind of problem, some different kind of person, and every single day is exciting. There's an element of thrill in every single day, because when people come through my door, it's not because they're kind of like bummed out and they got depression, or you know, they're nervous about taking a test or job performance, you know, like general anxiety, or because they're afraid of cats or things like that. They're coming to me because they have a very, very serious psycho-legal issue. So that means that there's a serious psychological problem, which may or may not exist, which is part of my job to figure it out, and it's attached to a legal issue. It could be in criminal court issue, it could be in the child protection court, which deals with abuse and neglect. It could be a civil court issue where people are fighting over a particular event that took place and there's a lawsuit related to it. Or it could be something like a school-related issue, like school threat assessment, something like that. So there's always a very enthralling aspect of what's going to happen each day, and I always get a packet of paperwork that comes in that sort of gives me a thumbnail sketch of what I'm going to be getting into. But that's just the veneer over it, you know? So it's really like getting into a project every single day, which keeps things very exciting. There's nothing mundane about the work.
Great. That's a great overview. What is the best part of your job? What do you like the best?
That's simple. And maybe you'll learn more about this about me during my presentation today in this interview. But for me, I always wanted to have control over my time. And the beauty about what I do is that I do have control over my time. I was not built and designed to be a 9-to-5-er, work for a corporation, that sort of thing. And having the ability to have control over my time gives me the flexibility to really be an architect of my career. So I guess some of the advice that I want to impart to all of you today is that you really need to think creatively about your future, not just as students, but as future professionals, and whatever that you do. And think about how important the commodity of time is, not just getting out, paying back your student loans, making a living, but really time, because time is, as we all know, scarce, and it's limited and finite. And being able to do what you want to do with your time when you want is invaluable. So that's something that I would encourage all of you to continue to ponder and think about as you transition through the rest of your educational careers.
That's an interesting take. We haven't discussed that in any of the previous interviews, of which, you know, we've already done a bunch now. This is, I think, like the 6th or 7th interview we've done, right? So that's great. So, counterpoint, what's the worst part of your job? Which part do you most dislike being involved in? The hardest to deal with, maybe. Yeah.
So the hardest part to deal with, I would say, in what I do is, I wouldn't call it like hard in the sense of not liking it or not enjoying it, I would reframe it and say it's challenging, because quite honestly, there really isn't a whole lot that I don't like about what I do. What I would say is most challenging is keeping abreast, right? And being knowledgeable about all the different cases and people that come through my door, right? Because remember, it's not the same thing every day. So if I was a physician and I'm a bone doctor, then it's like, okay, we got a break on an ankle, we got a break on a foot, we got a break on an arm. You know, you follow the procedure and the methods and cast it and you heal it and it's solved, right? What I deal with is a unique person every single day coming in with unique issues. And maybe I saw a little bit of this before. Maybe I saw domestic violence before. Maybe I saw a murder case before. Maybe I evaluated a kid who is under suspicion or person of interest for school threat assessment. But every single person is different. So the challenge is to be aware of my biases. You've probably talked about biases in your coursework in some capacity. We all have them, right? So one of the challenges of my work is to remember not to be prejudicial, which is going in with biases and prejudices about what I think this person is going to be like because of the other cases that I saw like that, or because of the other people that I dealt with like that, or because of the paperwork that I read about this person. It's really central in the work that I do and challenging to remember to do it and be mindful about it every single day to maintain a stance of objectivity. That's key to really performing in an optimal level, having that objectivity.
Great. Obviously respecting confidentiality, could you maybe give us an example of an interesting case that you've been involved with in the last week or two?
The last week or two. So I've got some really interesting cases for my presentation. I don't want to do any spoiler alerts. On that. So let me just give me 1 second to think of a real nail-biter kind of case. So this week, I got a call back onto a case that I was previously involved on. And the short thumbnail sketch of it is, this case originated in child abuse court, we'll call it, which is in Connecticut. It's called Superior Court for Juvenile Matters. And the case came in and requested an evaluation, which is basically what I'm doing all the time. I'm doing various kinds of forensic psychological evaluations. And the basis of the case was that the mother had separated from the father. They had two children. And the father was alleging that the mother was influencing the oldest daughter to believe that she was medically ill with Lyme disease. And the father believed that she did not have Lyme disease, that the mother was actually doing this just for her own selfish needs, because she was unemployed and because she loved the girls in the family, and she just wanted them for herself, for her own psychological needs. So lo and behold, fast forward, I spend months on this case. And I evaluate everybody. The oldest daughter at the time was about 11 years old. And by all intents and purposes, all measurements of cognitive functioning, she was a genius. Literally a brilliant, brilliant kid. And she believed that she suffered from Lyme disease. And following her mother's insistence, she not only went for Lyme disease tests, which are these tighter tests that they do, and they check your blood, brought her to medical doctors and specialists, but then began a course of medical treatment. Part of the medical treatment was standard, but that didn't change the symptoms. The child never got better. So then what? So then we moved on to the kind of physicians that special in homeopathic remedies. And she went through a whole course of homeopathic remedies. Child didn't get better. Then we upped the antis, and she started getting, IV medication. And she took IV medication in addition to some of the other medications, and the child didn't get better. And at the end of this case, I came to the conclusion that, in the opinion, and I submitted my findings, and I testified in court about it, that this was a case involving a disorder called Munchausen syndrome by proxy, which is a disorder in which a parent usually a mother, if you look at the research, influences a child to believe that they're medically ill and the illness is in support of that person, that parent, staying in control of the relationship and manipulating the relationship and keeping that person to themselves and maintaining their level of dependency upon that parent. The court accepted my findings and literally suspended custody between the mother and the children because the same pattern of behaviors was continuing with the next youngest daughter in line. P.S. Anecdote. Because of all of this, the daughter also happened to miss like 85 days of school, which, as you can imagine, is against the law. But the mother was justifying the school absences because of the medical illness. So I get a call 2 weeks ago. I'm a lawyer, and now the case is in family court. Family court is basically where you have divorce, custody, battles, things like that. So a lawyer calls me up and says, hey, do you know the name of the Jones case? Sound familiar? Oh yeah, Jones case, I remember that case. So the lawyer says, well, I think I'm gonna need to retain you as an expert. What happened? What happened is the mother's parents, the children's maternal grandparents, went to court. They filed what's called a motion, which is basically a declaration to the court. And they told the court that the children, that the oldest daughter had disclosed that she was being sexually abused by the father and that she was at imminent risk of danger. And they basically abducted the child, both children. So here we are now, and this is what's laying on my desk. And you've got all these competing hypotheses, right? So did the father really sexually abuse the girls? Are the grandparents manipulating and doing the mother's bidding because of the impasse that they've been in? Because the mother, of course, never got custody of the kids because of this Munchausen issue that never got resolved. And at the end of this month, I'm scheduled to go in and testify on this particular case. But what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be reviewing all of the records that I was previously involved on. I'm going to be reviewing records from the daughter's current therapist. I'm going to be looking at other evidence that would either corroborate or not corroborate the allegations of abuse and discuss that in the context of the historical framework of the case and help the court make a decision about what's best for the kids. It's kind of easy, right?
That was exactly my summary, I think. It's like forensic psychology is always just so cut and dry.
Yep.
And very, very smooth. Yeah. So let's go back a little bit. So how do you remember how you first got interested in psychology?
I do. It was actually a sort of embarrassing thing. But at this point in time, it's somewhat inconsequential for my own self-esteem. But I got interested in psychology in high school. And the reason why I got interested in it was because it was basically the only thing that I was good at. I wasn't good at math. I really didn't care for the sciences in a really deep level. Kind of liked writing, but I liked creative writing, and that really wasn't part of the curriculum. But the psychology I was enthralled with, and the reason why I knew that I was enthralled with it was because every second that I had available, I would go to the library and pull out psychology books. So instead of reading all the other books that I was supposed to be reading, I went to the library, pulled out psychology books, researched, you know, and really immersed myself in it and thrived on it. And I really literally knew from that day forward that I was going to do something in psychology. I didn't have any notion of whether I was going to become a psychologist, let alone a forensic psychologist, but I knew psychology was something that was just a natural fit. And I think, you know, the take-home message perhaps for you is, regardless of, you know, where you're at in your careers and what your interests are, you know, you know what you're internally passionate about, right? What really gets you excited and curious and enthusiastic. And if it's something that you're curious and excited and enthusiastic about and it stands the test of time, that's probably a good compass to follow for a while. You know, it may change, and that's okay too. But if you're struggling to sort of think about, you know, where your fit is, that would be a good starting place.
Great. You know, one of the things we're very concerned with here, and especially myself as chair of the department, is how do you create an undergraduate psychology experience that really helps people who are in the program prepare for life after the program, when we don't really know where they're going, right? Many of them don't go into any sort of careers in psychology. What was your undergraduate experience like? Looking back, do you feel like it gave you some tools that really prepared you for your later career as a full-time psychologist?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I've thought, honestly, before today's talk, I think about that a lot, and I don't know if it's just sort of like the place that I'm at in my career. I was interestingly passing through Fordham's campus yesterday. I was down at a threat assessment conference in the city, and Fordham's my alma mater down in the Bronx, and so it rekindled some interesting memories, as you can imagine. But undergraduate for me was really an opportunity to learn, right? It was a real think tank experience for me, and I loved it. You know, I was like, throw me in the deep end of the pool. I want to know anything and everything that I can possibly learn while I'm here. I really sort of got it in terms of understanding the privilege of being at a university and having access to faculty and research and experiences and such. So it was a great learning experience. And I would say whatever options or opportunities that are available, take them, because they'll probably never happen again. And if you don't take them, you may end up regretting it, even if it's something like you're not sure and it's like you'd rather spend 6 hours doing something else instead of volunteering on somebody's study or this or that. You can always learn something from that. And more importantly, you can have an opportunity to have that mentoring experience with the professor that you may be working with, or a grad student, or whoever. Now, the other side of the coin is, what did undergraduate experience not do for me? So my undergraduate experience, what it didn't do for me was it didn't prepare me for the real world, right? It really didn't. And I don't say that with any air of blame, because it really, in a way, it wasn't sort of my set of expectations. If it was, it was the kind of expectation where I think you have that naivety in your early 20s that you go into college, you're going to get a degree, you're going to walk out the door, and you're going to go to work somewhere, right? And, you know, you're smart enough, you studied enough, your GPA was good enough, you're hardworking enough, and, you know, you're just going to kind of land something, and it's all going to work out afterwards. It doesn't work that way anymore. And I would say that in today's modern age, it works that way even less. So I'm going to talk a little bit more during my presentation, but what I would encourage all of you to do is to spend as much time as possible doing things like this, where you meet real psychology majors, psychologists, people in the mental health field, doing different things, and ask if you can meet up with them. Have a cup of coffee, go to lunch, go to the bar, whatever. But really, take the time, write out your questions, and sit down, and you'd be surprised, you know, number one, how willing people are to do that. After all, we are the helping profession, right? So we'll do anything for anybody. And also the kind of information that you'll be able to get out of that, because you won't learn that in a textbook, and you may not learn that from the department or from the professors. And it's not their fault. It's because, you know, it's a different paradigm, and you can't do both at the same time 100%.
Wow, very good. Let me backtrack. We've had some vigorous discussions in this class about PhDs, PsyDs, the Boulder model. So the class is got some strong opinions about that. So what led you to choose your graduate program?
So again, this is kind of like one of those underdog stories. Maybe this goes back to why I'm Captain America. You know, so I was at Fordham University, and I was on, you know, on the track to go on to graduate school. I mean, that was sort of my planning, and as I learned more about sort of like the real world and what do you do when you finish and, you know, what kind of options are out there. Of course, we're getting to like the last semester, senior year. I was like, okay, yep, you know, it seems to make sense, go to graduate school. And I knew at that point in time that I wanted to go into clinical psychology. I spent enough time like learning the differences between counseling psychology, clinical psychology. Didn't have a clue about forensic psychology. Back then it was really completely off my radar, and it was a very, you know, sort of unstructured field, I would say, at that point in time. It didn't even have the nomenclature that it has in the APA right now. So I started preparing to go to graduate school. I had done everything that I should have done. I volunteered on research projects. I was telling Dr. Murphy on the way over here, I worked in the animal lab for about 2 years, down in the dungeon down there with these disgusting rats, and, you know, running experiments that I couldn't care less about. But, you know, it was, you know, you earn your way through the system. I worked with one of Lawrence Kohlberg's mentors, Ann Higgins, who was a pretty established professor, well-known publisher down at Fordham. I volunteered at numerous facilities, Bronx Children's Psychiatric Center, places in Connecticut when I came home from summer break. And what all this led up to, really, was applying to a whole bunch of graduate schools and not getting into any. And when that happened, then you say, okay, now what? And if you look at the statistics, the statistics are, you know, very, very odds against you of getting into a graduate program. And quite honestly, in hindsight, I didn't really know what I was getting into anyway. You know, it's kind of like, this is what you do. This is the way to go. This is, you know, how you sort of move forward in the food chain. But I really didn't know a whole lot about it. And it's a good thing that I didn't end up going, because it turns out that I really don't like doing research. And I probably would have been very, very miserable there in a traditional program. So this segues into another relevant answer to the question, which is, so then what do? So you at some point in time, all of you are going to find yourselves at some kind of crossroads. It may not be as dramatic as mine was, but you'll have it, because that's the way life goes. And what I ended up doing was taking a year off. And I decided that, okay, well, if I don't know what I'm going to do, I might as well do something for somebody else. And I took a year off, and I went and I volunteered in Ecuador, South America on a mission project. It was a good Jesuit university, and they had all kinds of Catholic connections all over the place, so that made sense, and it was easy. And the paperwork was much less cumbersome than graduate school paperwork. So I did that, and when I came back, I had gotten in touch with a friend of mine who he and I had gone to school together, and he was 2 years ahead of me. He says, "Hey, Eric," he says, "you know, I'm down in this program in Miami, and I'm in this forensic psychology track." He's like, "It's really fascinating." He's like, "You would love it." He's like, "It'd be right up your alley." So I go and I research it, and I almost instantly decided, this makes sense. I could see myself liking this. So the end of the story is, I applied, I got in, and I ended up going to, at that time, it was called the Miami Institute of Psychology, which was a professional school with a PsyD track. No research, very little, other than your dissertation. And it turned out to be a perfect fit. So there's no perfect way to move forward. I think there's advantages and disadvantages of all these programs, and I'm gonna spell a couple of the bullets out there in my presentation later. But I think the challenge for each of you is to really have one of those heart-to-heart talks to yourself and say, do I love, you know, learning and research and academia and the university environment so much that I want to, like, probably commit about 20 years to this, right? Because it's a little bit like a marriage, you know? And once you're in, it's not that easy to get out. Or alternatively, am I a more hands-on person? Do I want to work in a hospital? Do I want to be in a prison facility? Do I want to apply to work for the FBI? You know, do I want to be a practitioner in private practice? That kind of thing. And that's where you need to think about what skill set and what training is a match for that. It's all about matching.
Very good. Well, at this point, I usually turn it over to the class and see if individuals have questions. So fire away. Well, shoot, I guess that's a bad thing to say around a forensic psychologist. But
I have two questions. Well, you just finished your story. So how long did your PsyD track take?
Yep. So I would say that I probably did mine in record speed. And start to finish, I was done in 5 years. So what I mean by that is I completed 3 years of academic work, 12 months a year. In addition to the academic work, you do clinical training at the same time. So you're doing, you know, 6 hours at this clinic, 6 hours at that clinic, being supervised. And you're doing all of your academics 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Then you go away for an internship, which is mandatory. So you go for a 12-month internship, and you have to apply for that as well. And guess what? There's more students than internship slots. So it's a little bit like a lottery. And there's a lot of people that don't end up with a winning lottery ticket at the end. You have to think about, well, you know, that could be my crossroads. And it may not have anything to do with ability or your experience or your credentials. After your internship year, you do what's called a postdoc. Again, varies by state, but just about all states requires this. So to get your license to practice as a psychologist in the state of Connecticut, you have to have your degree and you have to have a 1 year of postdoc. Your postdoc is kind of like the armed forces. You get to sign up and volunteer your services again for another year and get paid a very humble amount of money and work about 50 hours a week and obviously learn and supervise a lot. I'm being a little bit cynical about this, but I want this to be very real for you so that you're not deluded into thinking that there's anything easy about any of this or that it's, you know, once you're in, it's sort of like a free pass and then one day you'll wake up and be a psychologist, because anything could be farther from the truth. So that's 5 years. I think the average used to be 8 to 9 years, and Dr. Murphy might know the statistic better than I would at this point in time, but when I was going through, the average was about 8 to 9 years. If you go into a traditional academic program, research, you know, where you're partially supported or funded and you're going to be there much longer because you're going to be involved in research projects and such, and there's just a set of built-in expectations for that.
The thing that scared me recently when I looked at the data was the average amount of student debt of a graduate student from a psychology program was $120,000, the average, which means that half the people are above that. Yeah, that's scary to me.
Very true.
Other questions? Now we've frightened everybody.
Anything. Feel free. This is your opportunity. Yes. Yeah.
And so what did you do the second time that you should have done the first time, or you think bettered your chances the second time?
You know what? I don't think it was anything as scripted the way that you're describing. I wish it was. I wish I could say it was this formula. I'm one of those people that kind of believes in karma and stuff like that. And I just think it was the right match, and it was the right time, and obviously having the right friendship with the right guy. And that's what did it. It was a very atypical process of getting into that school. So, you know, I had a phone interview. I didn't even have to fly down to Miami. I had very, like, super solid academic credentials, right? So there was no question, I think, about my raw ability. And I think part of the difference was in going to a professional school was, you know, I didn't have to have the research chops. They didn't expect it. They didn't care. It was irrelevant. So, you know, other than, you know, them taking a shot at me, you know, potentially being a lunatic and not wanting me to stay in the program, you know, I was a winning horse, you know, as a potential candidate. In professional schools, it's easier for them to unload students than, you know, traditional graduate school if it doesn't work out. It's less of a risk for them. But don't be scared. It'll all work out.
Rodrigo?
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Did you do any internships in your undergraduate program?
Yes, and so I think I did about, I want to say, well, I did no less than three. One, as I mentioned, was at Bronx Children's Psychiatric Center. One was at a place called Wellspring up here in Connecticut, up in Bethlehem. It's a residential facility for adolescent kids. And then the third that I did was at the Institute of Living, which is Hartford Hospital, IOL. It was a slightly different setup back then. And what I can tell you is, you know, all those places I worked my tail off, I learned an incredible amount of information. And two of those three I used for letters of recommendation all the way up going into my internship. In fact, I'll forever be indebted to Dr. Alan Carter, who was running the children's day treatment program at the IOL. We just clicked. I worked hard for him. I learned a lot from him. And he was always had my back corner. So, yeah.
One last question.
Yes.
You talk about all the different sections that psychology worked in. You mentioned school. Now, something like Sandy Hook, what would be your job in that?
Mm-hmm. Yep, great question. So I happen to have specialized in school threat assessment. Early as about 2001, when the U.S. Department of Education partnered with the U.S. Secret Service, and they started coming out with some very preliminary research about school shooters and what to do with that. It's really an evolving area, so I would say, like, if you're interested in that, that's a growth area, okay, to sort of specialize in. And I would say, like, a real practical piece is, what I do is I do the school threat assessment. So if a school has a student of concern, they're making allegations, they're cyber stalking, they're sexting, they're doing this, that, you know, cyber bullying, all of these kinds of things, then they may pull me in and say, look, we want to know if this is rising up to a level where there's going to be some kind of act of violence, okay? So that's And then I would evaluate that kid, go through my assessment procedure, which is pretty comprehensive, but as you can imagine, I would interview the student, I would interview some of the faculty and staff, I would interview the parents, I would administer psychological tests, I would look at the student's social media profiles that I could get access to. One case, I went to the student's home because I wanted to see what was in his bedroom and what kind of books he had and magazines and stuff like that. And fortunately, none of them ever rose to being sort of like an imminent risk of violence kind of scenario. So that's the kind of work that I would do. Now, it's very sensationalized. What you have to keep in mind is these school threat assessment kinds of profiler jobs that are portrayed on TV, yes, they're interesting, you know, they're exciting, they're learning, they're fun, you know, they're, you know, there's a huge element of safety involved, but there's also a very low base rate, right? Which means that they happen very infrequently, like a real issue of concern. The other 99%, they get managed in-house, you know, it's just a kid acting out, or it's somebody said something out of context, you know, on social media, that sort of thing. So it's not like, you know, three times a month I'm going out and doing a school threat assessment, okay? Where you could sort of carve out a niche for yourself in that area is on the prevention side. So now we've got over a decade of, you know, growing body of research, and now the issue is, okay, we really don't want to do these interventions, right? Who wants to deal with that? You know, let's deal with the safety side of this. How do we prevent that? How do we identify risk factors of kids early on? How do we connect them with services to address their areas of need and prevent this in the first place, so we don't have to have the Dr. Frasers of the world coming in and doing these safety threat assessment evaluations.
Great. Well, let's thank Captain America, Dr. Fraser.
Thank you.